This is the Tanana Yukon Historical Society's meeting of February the 23rd, 1967. And our speaker for the evening is Jim Cassidy. I'm substituting for a lost speaker, and I don't have my notes, my dates, and everything here. But I will try and give you a story of, I guess you could call it my life. I was born in San Francisco in November the 25th, 1901, in a section of southern San Francisco called Billy Goat Hill. Any resemblance is purely coincidental. My father's name was Earl James Cassidy. My mother's name before marriage was Isa Utterback. They were school children together in Iowa. They moved to California. I was born in San Francisco. I have had his sister Grace, that was born in Salinas, California, and is now deceased. Mother and dad are both gone. Dad was born in Iowa, and mother was born in Iowa. So we start our life in San Francisco as a baby in 1901, and between San Francisco, Salinas, and Monterey, our childhood was spent. Grade school in Salinas, and then I found myself working in Maryland Navy Yard. First, I drove truck in Salinas way back in the white truck days when they were solid rubber tires on the wheels, freighting, and then we moved to San Francisco. And I decided to serve my apprenticeship as a machinist. And I served quite a little time in Welchons and Simons machine shop on 18th Avenue. And after a strike was called, I went to Welchons and Simon. Pelton water wheel people, and then to the Marmon Motor Car Company up on Van Ness Avenue, where I found myself at about 18 years of age, and they went on a strike, so I went up to Yosemite National Park and drove stage for the summer. And just before I had gone to Yosemite National Park, I had gone up to Mare Island Navy Yard and put in my application to serve my apprenticeship as a machinist up there. And I spent that summer in Yosemite Park driving stage, first to the north of the park to the Hetch Hetchy project, and then to the south of the park to the Wawona Big Trees and Glacier Point, and would try to get up there as often as I could to help push the firefall over, if any of you have seen that. I came back to San Francisco just to receive notice that I had been accepted in the Maryland Navy Yard Apprenticeship School, where I served 4 years apprenticeship as a machinist, and then went down to San Francisco and contacted the Standard Oil Company and was hired on as a fourth assistant engineer in their tanker fleet. But at the end of 2 years of sea life, I found out I was a poor sailor. And sea life was not for me. I was seasick whenever there was a good, healthy storm on. And after 2 years of that, that was enough. It was a great disappointment to me because I had majored in marine engineering in my time at Mare Island Navy Yard. However, I promised to make one more trip. We'd made a trip to Philadelphia and back, and I was going to quit the ship in San Francisco. And they begged me to stay on. Oh, you'll get used to it. Just one more trip and you won't be seasick anymore. And foolishly, I accepted. And we took on a load of oil for Seattle. And on the way to Seattle, we had a beautiful northwester. And I was seasick all the way to Seattle. So when the boat pulled into the dock at Port Wells in Seattle, I had my sea bag packed. And it hit the dock before the heaving line did. And I found myself in Seattle, a young man, and I got a job with the Packard Motor Car Company and Packard Seattle Company up on Pike Street. I spent the next 7 years there, two of it climbing mountains with the mountaineers, and the others with the Washington Alpine Club, with whom I became very closely associated, and where I first met Magdalene. And at the end of 7 years, I had heard my uncle talk so much about Alaska and about hiking from Fairbanks to Valdez over the trail, about going down the Yukon River in a boat, that I just decided that I had to go to Alaska. So on May the 1st in 1931, I left Seattle on a cannery tender with a fellow Alpine Club member, Lyman Culver, and we worked our way on a cannery tender to Union Bay, 40 miles north of Ketchikan. At Union Bay, to help pay our passage, besides Lyman served in the pilot house on the way up and I served in the engine room to help pay for our passage, we helped unload the boat. But as soon as this big cannery tender was unloaded on the dock at Union Bay, we put our canoe in the water and headed for Nome, Alaska. We went up through the inside passage to Skagway, on the railroad over to Whitehorse, down the Yukon to St. Michael, and across to Kotlik, and across to St. Michael, and on up to Nome. And I spent the next 6 years in Nome. But to get back to this canoe trip, which had some very interesting experiences, I would start out at Petersburg. Coming into Petersburg, we had an old town 16-foot canoe with Lyman and I in it. We had a sail, oars, and a motor, and a big German police dog. And believe me, that fills up a canoe. And we had no extreme experiences until we were pulling into the Petersburg. Coming up through the Dry Straits and entering Petersburg late in the afternoon, we hit that narrow entrance into Petersburg Channel just at the riptide, just when the tide was its worst. And a good riptide, if you've never been in one, is where you're right on smooth water, and then waves are created and appear and disappear all around you in no set rhythm or shape of a current, but they just bob up first here and first here and first here. And first thing we knew, one bobbed up on top of the motor and drowned it out. And Lyman jumped to the oars, and I jumped to the bailing bucket and started bailing. And I believe we rode for an hour and couldn't move. And we could see half the town of Petersburg lined up on the beach watching us, wondering if we was going to succeed or go back out to sea or gain the harbor. But we'd take turns rowing, and we got into the harbor. And Lyman had worked up and down southeastern Alaska on cannery tenders and knew quite a few people. So after a week at sea with our canoe, we had the pleasure of joining friends on another cannery tender where we had a hot meal and a hot bath and a good night's sleep, and bought gas and oil and started out on up the inside passage the next morning and going out through this narrows into Queen Charlotte Sound. It was just as smooth as glass, and it was hard to believe that it had been as rough as it was the night before when we came in. But this was only a beginning of some of the experiences we had. We left the next morning and went out into Queen Charlotte Sound and turned north and went about 3 miles, and the wind came up so hard that we just had to go ashore and get out of it. And the shoreline there is quite rugged, little bays and harbors. So we pulled into this little shore and was camping there. I think we spent a day and a half waiting for the wind to die down. We thought it died down quite a little bit. It seemed so, but apparently it was just because we were in the shelter of the trees that it was actually smooth. And a little fishing boat came along, passed by the mouth of the little bay we was in, went up around the point, but we heard his motor stop and we heard him drop anchor. And that gave us an idea, and we were laying there in our sleeping bags, and we jumped out and jumped in our canoe and paddled up there to talk to him. And sure enough, he had gone just around the point out of sight and had dropped anchor and was working on something on the bow of his boat when we pulled up alongside of him. And it turned out that he had a big cast iron shiv, must have been 6 or 7 feet in diameter, with iron spokes and a big iron hub. It was a shiv that would go at the top of a gantry or an A-frame for a deep mine, where your winch and drum would go up over the shiv and then down the mine shaft. And he was taking that to his home harbor for an anchor. But it proved that there was too much weight on the bow of his little boat for this high wind and rough water, and was keeping his rudder out of water to such an extent that he couldn't hold steerage way. So he said, yes, I'll take you up far as I'm going. I'm going up to Three Brothers Island. If you'll help me get this shiv onto the stern of the boat so it'll hold the stern down, not the bow. So we helped him get the wheel on the stern of the boat, and we ran back around the point, the little bay, and threw all of our camp gear and everything in the canoe and came back and unloaded on his boat. But there was no room for the canoe, so we had to tow it. And we figured it wouldn't tow very good unless somebody rowed it to steer it. So I volunteered to steer this canoe. And to steer a canoe, we had an oarlock notch in the sternboard, so you could let your oar, single oar, trail out behind and sit there in the stern seat and use it for a rudder. So I sat back there and steered the canoe, and they took off. And they went out from this little bay they were in and out into the channel and started up the inlet. And I tell you, the farther they went, the rougher it got, and the higher the wind got, till it was really something terrific. I have never experienced anything like it in all my life, and hope never to again. But Queen Charlotte Sound, through that section there, there's about 12 or 15 miles that there's no harbor. There's no place to escape a storm. Once if you're out in it and going, you just have to keep it going. You don't dare turn back, and there's no shelter any place till you've reached 15 miles further on. So I sat back there and was towed at the end of for near 100 feet of line, and it was an awful thrill. And those waves got bigger and bigger. Those big ones would come up and go down until it was all right for a long time. The launch, the tugboat, the fishing boat he had was climbing this wave when I was climbing the other one, and I was running down the next one when he was, and everything was lovely for quite a while, until these waves got mussed up somehow, and they was out of time. There wasn't any rhythm to it, and this tow line had sunk down through this wave, and I would be gliding down this one when he was climbing this one. And that tow line had sunk down through that big green wall of water in front of me till I visualized when he started down the other side of the next one, he was going to bore me right through that green water. But this was an Old Town Sponson canoe, and it rode over each one. But about the middle of that trip, I got my shoes off and my shirt off, and I figured I'd have to go swimming before the thing was over. And I never believed the canoe could take that much punishment, because sometimes I was going down one when he was going up the other, and a lot of slack would occur in the line, and then it would come taunt and try to bore me through that green water right straight ahead. But she would always just barely float up over and go on. So we got up opposite Three Brothers Island. That's the lower end of Prince of Wales Island, where you turn right to go up the channel toward Petersburg, or toward Juneau. And Three Brothers Island was his home. He had a home there, and his wife was waiting for him, and he had a fox farm there. But when we got up opposite what he called Home Harbor, it was too rough. He couldn't cross over to it, but there was a little bay just opposite that, and we pulled in there, and I couldn't move. I couldn't move an arm. I couldn't move a leg. They had to just pick me up out of that. I was sitting there holding that oar, steering that canoe for so long and soaking wet. But we got over it all right. We went over and stayed at his home for about 2 days to the next day, till the wind died down. I have an old dictionary that his wife, it was brand new, I was just taking it on the trip, and his wife covered it with cloth. She took one of her nice clean white dish towels and laid it down and opened the covers and folded it inside and sewed it together, and I still have it. It's filthy black now, but it's such a treasure that I wouldn't lose it. So we'll go on from there. We got up to Taku Arm, entering into Juneau. And we'd been stormbound quite a few days by then, and we was getting quite panicky about time. We both had jobs waiting for us in Nome. So we got up ready to... We went up alongside of Prince William Island to Taku Harbor. Now that's a little indentation or bay where there's a cannery just before you cross the Taku Arm to go on into Juneau. And we started across that arm, and the Taku wind was coming down that draw so bad that it burner swamped us, and it took me about 15 minutes before I could find a safe place to make a turnaround to retreat out of there. So we went back and stayed all night at this cannery at Taku Harbor. And the next morning, their local cannery tender was going into Juneau for mail and groceries, and they said, "Well, you fellas want to go along, throw your canoe on, ride up with us." And we said, "That's swell, we'll do that." So we threw our canoe on and rode up with him, and across Taku Arm was just a smooth glass. And the day before, it drove us out of there with such a terrific wind and so rough. But we made it up to there. We went on up to Skagway, and I visited there for a couple of days, and we bought passage over to White Horse on the White Pass Railway. And I'll never forget how it broke our heart. We were just a couple of young bucks and didn't have very much money. And they allowed us to put our canoe on top of a full load of lumber on a flat car. Now, I consider they're already getting paid per tonnage that's hauled on that flat car because it's already 100% loaded with lumber. But they go measure our canoe, and we have to pay for volume instead of weight. So we have to pay for about 3 ton of freight to White Horse when we actually only had about 400 pounds. Excuse me. But that put us into White Horse. And we went up to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and requested permission to go down the Yukon. And they wanted to see our boat and wanted to know how much we knew about canoeing and so forth. Apparently there was two young men there wanting to go down the river with a canoe. They wouldn't let them go, and we had heard about that just before we went up to the Mounted Police barracks, and we wondered what difficulty or trouble we would have. But it turned out that these boys got a little smart and sarcastic, I presume, so they were just letting them cool their heels for a few days before they let them go down. But we didn't have a bit of trouble. And we started out from White Horse for Nome. We went to Lower LaBarge, a matter of about 30 miles. And here, the Lake LaBarge is about 32 miles long, and it was solid with ice. And the upper end of the lake was open for about a half a mile out from shore, and we went tried to get around each side of it, and it was solid up onto the shore on both sides, so we went back into the mouth of the river and camped. And I remember shooting tree squirrels and cooking them for about 2 days, and finally we heard a launch come along, and we ran out on the bank from this old log cabin, and it was the Loon, a little tugboat or launch, you might call it, that serves the Stern Wheelers and White Horse, and we ran out and talked to him, and he had was going down to the mouth of the river where it enters into Lake LaBarge and test the depth of the water over the bar into deep water, and if it was deep enough, the White Horse, the steamer White Horse, would come down that evening and cross over this bar out into deep water and drop anchor. And then the Loon would bring two or three barge loads of freight down to finish loading the White Horse and the barges in front of her, because if they loaded her that heavy at White Horse, she couldn't get into the lake over this shallow bar. So we waited till the White Horse came down, and the Keno came down, and the Casca came down, and all laid out there in deep water at the edge of this ice. So we ran out and talked to the purser on the White Horse, and we bought passage across Lake LaBarge for our canoe and ourselves. So we loaded everything up and ran out there. Now the White Horse was pushing two barges ahead of her. And we went up to the forward barge and climbed up on the bow and pulled our canoe and our dunnage up, and we camped right there on the front end of the boat. Front end of the barge. These barges are covered like a boxcar is, and they're piled high with groceries on each side. There's two companionways. The center section's high with groceries, high as you can reach, and both outside of the both companionways, and we sat up on the roof. And we took what is called the Lamp Black Trail. Now, the Lamp Black Trail may be new to a lot of you, but it was a habit in those days, in order to get navigation going sooner and to get the ice to break up in Lake Labarge sooner, they took a Ford truck with a regular manure spreader behind it, and they fed it lamp black, and they drove across this lake in exactly the channel that a boat would go from upper Labarge to lower Labarge, spreading this lamp black, and it crystallizes and helps melt the ice sooner, and they can get their early navigation season started a little sooner than usual. So they call it the Lamp Black Trail. So we started out on the Lamp Black Trail, and we went along fine for a few miles, and then the ice got thicker and thicker, and it was a tremendous experience to sit on the bow of that boat and see the stern wheeler back up and then take full speed ahead and run and drive that front barge up onto the ice till two-thirds of its length was up on the ice, and then it'd break through. And then they would back up, and they'd paddle wheel and throw all this broken ice out behind, and they'd take another run at it. And we spent about 2 days doing that, just making down halfway down the lake. And this groove was as wide as the boat and the barges, and behind us was the Keno, and behind her was the Casca. And finally, this morning, they drove the barge up onto the ice, and it didn't break through, and they couldn't pull it off. And there we were. So they struggled for a long time, and they were so late by then that they figured they'd better call in and let the home office know where they were. So I remember I joined two other boys, and we hiked ashore with a telephone and climbed halfway up this mountain and hooked onto the telegraph wire and called Whitehorse and told them where we were and why. Came back to the boat, and they were blasting and dynamiting, and they finally pulled the barge loose and started the old procedure again of backing up and going forward for 32 miles to break through that ice. We broke out into open water at the lower Labarge, the lower end of the lake, and the Keno and the Casca were coming right behind us. The Casca had a barge in front of her with a load of cattle on it, and they had driven holes into that barge, and it was sinking. And when we came out into this open water at the lower end of the lake, it was the same as the upper end of the lake. I would say there was a mile at each end of the lake that was open. The outlet to the lake was open, and for a mile up the lake was open. So when we break out of this field of ice, we've got a mile of open water to go down to enter the river to go on. And the Casca had to break out of this into the open water and run quick to shore and let her cattle, I think some of them had to swim ashore before they got the barge ashore. But in the mouth of the river was a river boat, I don't recall which one, that was froze in there the fall before trying to return to Whitehorse for the winter. They were a little too late, and they got froze in and had to leave it at lower Labarge. So on the Whitehorse was a skeleton crew to get steam up in this boat and take it back to Whitehorse and refurbish it and get it ready for the summer season. So the Whitehorse pulled up and tied up alongside of this river boat, and while they did, Lyman and I put our canoe in the water and our dog and our duffel and took off. And there was quite a crowd of tourists on the upper deck watching us. They had seen us load up at upper Labarge, and they'd seen us unload at lower Labarge, and they heard who we were and so forth the 3 or 4 days that we were on the lake. So we took off, but there's a crooked little bend right where the lower end of the lake comes together, and the steamer was tied here for the winter, and they tied up alongside of it, and we took off. And as soon as you start down the 30-mile river, you have to make a quick S like that, and we took off in that. But all this ice we'd broken loose fighting our way across the lake and come down with a current too, and it was milling through here just when we took off. And believe me, when you look at chunks of ice as big as this table coming together, and you're out in the middle of them in a little canoe, and of course everybody was standing on the deck wondering if we were going to make it or not. But we went around the corner and out of sight down the 30-mile river. At the lower end of the 30-mile river, where the Teslin River comes in, is the little village of Hootlinka, which used to be a mounted police station, and we stopped there for the night. Now, this 30-mile river, because it comes out of a lake as big and long as Lake LaBarge, Lake LaBarge acts as like a perfect settling basin, so the water's clear as diamonds until you reach the Teslin River. The 30-mile river is 30 miles long, and that strip of river is just as clear as a mirror, and it's full of big granite boulders in the bottom. And while I guess they're maybe 4 or 5 feet below your keel of your boat, it looks like every one you go over, it's going to tear the bottom right out of your boat. But we shot a few ducks on the way down and had something to eat besides squirrels that we'd had at the upper LaBarge. And we stopped all night where we entered the Teslin River. Now, where the Teslin and the 30-mile join from there on, it's called the Yukon. So we stayed at this little old place called Hootlinka for the night. So we were positive that during the night, while we were camped and sleeping, that the white horse had surely come by and passed us. We just didn't see it or hear it. So we got up the next day and we went on downriver. And we came to Carmax. I don't think we stopped. We came on down to Selkirk. We got into Selkirk late in the evening, about 9 o'clock at night. And everybody wanted to know where the white horse was. I said, well, heaven's sakes, it must be Bernard Dawson by now. Oh, no, we've all got our summer supplies on it, the first boat of the spring, and we're all out of everything. Where is the white horse? Where is the white horse? Well, it wasn't until we got to Dawson that we found out that a big ice jam formed in the 30-mile river right behind us, and the white horse was just ahead of this jam. And the river ran out of water, and it let her set down on one of these big boulders, and she was stuck there for a number of hours. And with the water lowering and this ice jam getting more secure and blocking off the flow of water to her, that she was settling on this big boulder and threatening to put a hole in the bottom of her, when finally the ice jam broke loose and brought water enough down to float her, and she went on. She got on down into the Yukon River, and some of those big bends are tremendous big bends. There's big cut banks, bare dirt, 600-700 feet high, some of them. And you know, a riverboat is about 99% out of the water and about 1% in the water. And with a good high wind, that just acts like a sail. And it'll push that boat right over against the bank and hold it there. And they can't move, they can't get away, they just got to wait till the wind dies down. They can't go forward, they can't back up, they're just anchored there. So besides being stuck in the 30-mile with an ice jam, she was pushed over against the bank with a high wind after she got in the Yukon and held for several hours more until we stopped at Selkirk and went on to Ballarat Creek and Coffee Creek. Coffee Creek was our next thriller, as I call it. We were studying our map, and it was about time for dinner, and we figured now we'll stop at Coffee Creek and have something to eat. And when we pulled up on the bank at Coffee Creek, there was a nice little log cabin there, and this cabin had nice white lace curtains on the windows, and that told us that there must have been a woman in that cabin. But we went up and knocked on the door, and there was no one home. So we went back down on the beach and cooked our lunch and wondered who lived here and where they were now, and we climbed up on the corner of a woodshed and looked downstream through a great flat of willows, and we could see what looked like some radio antenna poles down there about 3 miles, and we figured there must be another village down there. We'd been sitting in the canoe so long that we wanted to get a little exercise, so we decided to walk down there just for to get some leg exercise. So we started walking. I'll never forget it. I was in the lead. And we enter these tall willows and a narrow trail, and it's a crooked trail. You can't see very far ahead of you. And I'm walking down there pretty fast, and here comes a horse's head around the bend up to me. And underneath it, as it comes farther around, here's a woman leading a horse. And she just has a man's shirt on, and no brassiere. And both her breasts are showing, and her shirt's open, burnt her down to her navel. And she's all blood. And I thought, oh my God, what's happened here? And then the rest of the horse comes around the curve where you can see it, and here's the black bears draped across the saddle. And she was tickled to death to see us and just almost fell all over us and made us come back to her cabin and open up her cabin, and she cooked dinner for us and she just talked an ear off of us. She hadn't had company for several months. Her husband was across the river and up cutting wood for the steamboats. And it turned out that she had been trapping. She had traps set up on the mountain, and she caught this bear and shot it, gutted it. And she couldn't get it into the saddle without actually just trying to pick it up and hugging it against her to get it up onto this saddle. And she had herself all smeared with blood. But she brought that bear in, and we went back with her, and she opened up her cabin, and she just talked the leg off of us. Now, it happens that she has friends here on 2nd Avenue or 1st Avenue, and Lyman knew them. So that gave us a little more closer relationship, I guess, and she just talked the leg off of Lyman. And she could use the English language and all the miners' language, and there was no end to the swearing that she could produce in just her ordinary conversation. And telling shady stories, too. So we had a nice dinner with her, and we came out to continue our trip. But she had to see our rifles first. She had to come down and see our canoe, and when she got on the bank and saw our canoe and how little it was and saw our guns, she had to see them. She had to go back and get her gun, and she had to shoot each one of our guns, and she wanted us to shoot her gun. And I'll never forget it. There was a little chip coming down out in the middle of the river, about 2 foot long, and it looked like about 4 inches wide, and when it's way out midstream and floating down, you know. And she took a crack at it, and she was a little high, and Lyman took a crack at it, and he was a little low. And I took a crack at it with mine, and I must have hit it dead center, because there was no bullet splash either beyond or near the board. And she thought that was pretty wonderful. And we went back to the canoe and started packing up to go. And she looked downstream, and here's a big black cloud coming up. And it's just, you can tell it's going to be a thunder shower and just pouring down rain. She said, "My God, you kids can't leave with that coming up. Come back in the house and wait till that blows over." And we were there the rest of the afternoon, and it poured down rain, and she wouldn't let us leave. And she cooked a big dinner for us, so we decided to stay overnight and start out the next morning. Well, we went out in a woodshed behind her cabin and spread out our sleeping bags, and I guess she'd let the native Indians sleep there, and it was lousy. And we slept there all night, and we were sleeping the next morning when she had been up and cut up this bear and hung it up to dry and hung the skin up to dry and had cooked breakfast for us, and we still weren't up. And of course this was only about 6 o'clock by then. And so she had to come out and look around the corner of this woodshed in there to where we was leaving, and she had to stand there. "Well, Jesus, aren't you ever going to get up? Breakfast is going to waste for you." Well, let's leave her. We finally got away and went on down the river, and we came to Ogilvie, the last stop before Dawson. It's about 40 miles from Dawson. And Mr. Ogilvie lives there in his cabin, and the Ogilvie River is named after, and I guess he's a famous surveyor, and surveyed all of the Klondike and Dawson country from A to Z. First, I want to go back to Selkirk, just before we got to Coffee Creek, to tell you the kind of people we ran into. We pulled up on the bank about 9 o'clock at night at camp at Fort Selkirk. Everything was closed and everybody's gone to bed. We went up and knocked on the store door, and the storekeeper got up and came to the door and invited us in. And everybody calls us by our name, Culver and Cassidy. "Lyman Culver and Jim Cassidy, where have you been? We've been looking for you for days and days." We had that greeting wherever we went. We didn't realize that our pictures were in the Alaska Weekly when we sailed out of Seattle. In fact, the PI had come down on had came down onto Pier 3 and taken a picture of our canoe and the two of us sitting in it. And it was in the next week, Alaska. It was in the next day's Seattle PI. And when we got off onto the dock at Union Bay from the cannery tender, the Alaska steamship came by, and all the tourists and everybody lined the rail, all looked down, and, well, there's Cassidy and Culver, there's their canoe, and three or four people threw us the Seattle PI from the Sunday before because they was giving us our picture. I have those in my little dictionary yet, too. So this storekeeper opened the door and invited us in, locked the door behind him. He says, I've only got a little one-room sleeping room here, but we'll fix you up with something. And he brings out two folding canvas cots and puts them in the middle of the aisle in this hardware store with jewelry and watches and knives and everything on this side and all kinds of dry goods on this side. He says, I hope you fellows have a good night's sleep. And he goes back in his bedroom, closes the door, and goes to sleep. And we're sitting there undressing to go to bed in the middle of this hardware store, and I can't get over it. It says, this man don't know us from Adam. Here he's turning us loose in the middle of the whole store. That was the first one. The next one was when we got to Ogilvie's. We pulled up there on the bank, and this old man heard us, and he came to the door, and he says, what are you doing out there? He says, come in here and go to bed and get up in the morning like a white man. And he made us go in and lay our sleeping bags on the floor at the foot of his bed and go to sleep, because it was about midnight. And he was up bright and early in the morning and had a nice big breakfast of sourdough hotcakes for us. And we were sitting there enjoying them when the steamer White Horse went by. And everybody saw our canoe on the bank and was waving to us, you know. So she beat us into White Horse by about 2 hours. Otherwise, if we hadn't stopped overnight at Ogilvie, we'd have beat the White Horse, the steamer White Horse, from White Horse to Dawson. So we got into Dawson the next morning, about an hour after the White Horse arrived there. And we immediately walked up to the mounted police barracks and upstairs and down this long hall to turn into this sergeant's room. And I said, Culver and Cassidy reporting. Yes, yes, he says, I saw you a half hour ago coming down the river. His big front window looked right up the Yukon. He could see us coming down. He says, that's fine. You have a good trip. I said, yeah, we want to leave. We're late. We want to get started. That's fine. Just check in with the mounted police down at 40 Mile when you pass by there, and that's all that's required. So we bought a few groceries and went and looked at Robert Service's cabin and took off down the Yukon River. And we're going down the right limit, and the river's under half a mile wide. And there's a little riverboat coming up the other limit with some old guy with old coveralls and old hat on. He waves at us, and I wave back and keep on going. And pretty soon he turns and takes after us. And we couldn't figure what was wrong. And he came over, and he was a mounted policeman from 40 Mile and checking us out. And I thought, well, gee, I thought you guys all had red and purple on, big 10-gallon hat and so forth. I said, you look like a bum. He says, I'm just going up after supplies. So we went down to 40 Mile and stayed all night. And then the next day we made it to Eagle, and we checked in with the U.S. Customs there, and we took off from Eagle, headed on down the river, and we was about a half an hour out of Eagle, and we broke the crankshaft in our motor. So it was a case of float and roll the rest of the way to Eagle. To Circle City, I mean. We left Eagle, and just out of Eagle, we broke the crankshaft to our motor, and we rode and floated to Circle City, and we pulled up on the bank at Circle City in front of the NC store and went in and talked to the store manager. And the road to Fairbanks was closed. It went over the mountains someplace and wouldn't be open for a long time. That's the only place else that we could buy another motor to continue with, and we were just about out of money and didn't know what to do about it. And so we decided that we would the steamer White Horse would be down the next day, going on down to Tanana. And if we wanted to get out of there and get to our jobs in Nome that were waiting for us, we'd have to decide to do something. So we decided to sell a canoe and buy transportation on the White Horse down to Tanana. Because at Tanana, we've heard about so many times the Reliance and a couple of other of these little launches that all these grocery salesmen go down the Yukon with the first thing in the spring, selling groceries to all the different traders along the river. And Lyman knew some of them and felt sure if we got as far as Tanana, we could catch a ride on down as far as St. Michael. So the store manager showed an interest in our canoe. So we figured we could sell it to him and thereby have money enough to get to Tanana. Now I had wired home for money the minute we got to Circle City and told him to send it on to Tanana and I would get it there. So Lyman and I went out and talked it over about what we would sell our canoe for. He had a young son, he wanted to have it to go duck hunting with around Circle City. Well, we paid $35 for the canoe over in Kirkland, Washington, and running across Lake Union, down through the locks and through Elliott Bay and over to Pier 3 and fixed it up and put a sail on it and raised the gunwale about 4 inches all around for rough water travel and bought a new pair of oars. And, we were going to take the motor with us, so we figured, we'll ask $75 for it. And if we can't negotiate that, we can drop back down to $65 or $50. So we made that up. So we went in to talk to the storekeeper, and the minute we went through the door, well, fellas, have you decided, will you sell the canoe to me? I want it awful bad. Well, yes, I would. We've got quite a little bit in it, though. We put the oars on it, and we put the sail on it, and we put that 3-inch of freeboard on it. Well, how much will you give us for it? He said, well, you take $300. I said, sold! Boy, right now. And we packed up, and it wasn't 2 hours later, the White Horse came around the bend and pulled in there and tied up to the dock, and we was on it with our extra motor and our dog and our camp gear, and we rode the White Horse down to Purgatory and Fort Yukon and Stevens Village. And at Tanana, she turns and goes up to Nenana. And we get off at Tanana, the old tower house there, and we look around and we go up to, I rush up to ACS and my money hasn't come that I wired for at Circle City. So what are we going to do? We got some money in our pocket and we got more coming, no transportation. We heard the Reliance had gone down the river about a week ahead of us, so we missed her. But we had one out. Hans Myro was flying from Nome to Fairbanks, and we knew in the end if we got stuck, we could holler, and we could fly over to Nome with him. But we wait a couple of days trying to figure what to do, and there's a little Jap has a restaurant at Tanana. So we'd go in there in the morning for coffee. And I want you now to remember this woman at Coffee Creek, and now this little Jap at Tanana, because we went in there the next day for coffee and waiting for the ACS to open at 10 o'clock to go up and see if our money had come yet. And there's a man sitting in there drinking a cup of coffee, and his name is L. McGee. And we get to chatting and talking. He says, well, I just came up from Anchorage and put my boat in the water at Tanana, at Nenana. And I'm down here, and I was thinking of going on up toward Rampart and open up a trading post, but the wife doesn't want to. I'll sell you my boat and motor. Well, we'll go up and look at it. So we have coffee and pie in the Japs' little restaurant there, and we walk up the beach about a mile to where Mr. McGee is camped. And we look over, and he's got a shovel-nosed riverboat and a 22 Johnson, and he'll sell the whole thing for $250, and that's all we had. After buying passage for the two of us from Circle City to Tanana, that was just $250. It was every blessed penny we had, and we bought the motor and the boat and loaded our gear in it, and we didn't have any gas to run it, or couldn't buy any oil for the gas. And there was a salesman came in there. He owns part of the Baranoff Hotel. I've lost his name right now. Meacham, Meekin, M.E. He was a coffee salesman. Anyway, he heard about us, and he came down to it, and he says, "Say, fellas, if you'll take me down to Ruby, I'll buy you the gas to Ruby." I says, "You're on." So he bought 2 5-gallon cans of gas and a quart of oil, and he came down with a bag full of oranges, and we started up the motor, and we delivered him to Ruby. And I immediately run into ACS at Ruby. And my money hasn't come to Circle City yet, hasn't been transferred to Tananaw, and hasn't reached Ruby. And we're out of gas, no money. And I run up to the ACS office, and there's a Mr. Groudon there running the ACS office. And, I'm disappointed. Our money didn't come, and it takes gas to get on down to Nulato. We need some groceries. And what are you doing about it? He says, "Go in and buy what you want and charge it to me and go on your way." I looked at him. I said, "What the hell are you talking about, mister?" I said, "People just don't do that. I'm a total stranger. I just landed on the bank of the river 5 minutes ago, and here you're telling me to walk in there and buy what I want and go on." "Oh, well," he says, "I know a good-looking face when I see it. Go get what you want and go on. When your money comes, I'll send it on to you." Well, that was my second experience with Alaskans. So I went in and bought 2 cases of gas and $5 worth of groceries, and I went on. We went on. Mr. Groudon, I'll never forget him. We get down to Nulato, and we have a telegram for Mr. Groudon. "Your money has arrived at Ruby. If you will wire me permission to cash your check, I will take out what you owe me and send you the rest," which he did. So we got to get through this, or we'll be all this whole tape just getting down the Yukon River. So we went on to the mouth of the river. Now, I thought they were highway binders when I bought gas in Dawson and had to pay 75 cents a gallon for it. And I bought it from the NC Company. And when we got down to Kotlik at the mouth of the river and had that 75 miles of open water facing us, staring us in the face between there and getting into St. Michael, Kotlik was another NC store, and I had to pay $1.50 a gallon for gas there. And I thought they were the biggest highway binders in all the world, and I'd never spend a penny with them the rest of my life. Boy, I was through with them. But we crossed the open water from St. Michael and went in that back channel from Cape Romanoff and snuck into St. Michael early in the morning. And the NC was there. Now, that's one of the NC company's tugs, and its name is NC. I think it's spelled N-E-S-E-E. And it was unloading the Victoria. And there was somebody there with a little stern wheeler from Pilot Station getting his freight. And we went over and stevedored on his boat for a few hours. And as I earned my first silver dollar in Alaska, helping unload freight from the steamer Victoria and putting it on the riverboat. And the boat was unloaded, and we were so late that we decided to buy passage from St. Michael to Nome. Or we were afraid our jobs would be lost. So we buy passage on the Victoria from St. Michael to Nome. We run over to Unalakleet and unload a little freight and pull into the home roadstead at Nome the next morning. And that's some high wind and a big storm on. They pick our boat up and lower it in the water, and we take off about 3/4 mile to go to shore at Nome. And the Coast Guard had been out there, and they tried to come out to the boat, and they got halfway out, and their motor broke down. And we went over and tried to tow them in, but that hurt their feelings, so they wouldn't let us tow them in. So we ran into the mouth of Snake River and up to the bank and tied up, and we were in Nome. We went up and got jobs and worked there all that summer. My partner went out that winter, and I stayed in Nome, got me a little cabin, and was going to spend my first winter in the Arctic and see what it was like. During the dead of the winter, there was a Catholic mission north of Nome, about 75 miles, and my neighbor was going over there and help him out a little bit, a little free labor. He was a plumber, and apparently they used hot water from this springs to heat their buildings, and they corroded all the pipes. And, I had nothing to do, and the Chief Chopker didn't know anything about the country, and he coaxed me to come along, keep him company, and to help him a little bit. So I went over to Pilgrim Springs and helped him put in a lot of new piping. I came in contact with the brothers and sisters there and the father. And I'm not Catholic, and I didn't know how I would be accepted, but everything was lovely. It turned out to be a very close and deep friendship among a whole bunch of us. And it was there I learned to drive dogs. They had a dog team. I spent the next 6 years in Nome, traveling all over Seward Peninsula with my own dog team, climbing mountains in the wintertime, working in the summertime. But I want to touch on one point. My first winter at Pilgrim Springs, they had a little radio, and about the only radio station in Alaska was KFQD in Anchorage. And it had just come into existence, and it was a lot of fun for all the local people all over Alaska to write KFQD. If you had a friend, a partner, or a brother in Fairbanks, and you wanted to send and had a cousin in Bethel, or Bethels, or Ruby, or any other place, you could write him a little letter to KFQD, and they'd read it over the air, and your brother would hear it, and he'd write them a letter, and they'd read it over the air, and you'd hear it. So I thought it'd be quite nice, so I wrote a little letter to Mr. Groudon at Ruby, and told him that we had successfully navigated the length of the Yukon River, and I found myself at Pilgrim Springs spending my first winter in Alaska, and how extremely grateful I was to him and the wonderful kindness he extended to me in offering me gas and oil and groceries and tell me to go on my way. And I sent him a Christmas greeting that way. And away up in January it was, I was out helping do the chores and so forth, and we used to always try to get by the radio at 9:15 at night when KFQD would start reading these letters. And sure enough, here came an answer back from Mr. Groudon. He was very happy to have heard my letter and hoped I liked it in Alaska. So we'll go on and skip that till 5 years go by, 6 years go by, and I've seen all the Seward Peninsula I want, and I want to see the interior, and I want to go outside for the winter. And I met a young lady working in Spokane, and she came over and moved over to Seattle and was working there when I left, and so I caught the boat in the spring, and this young lady promised to come up and marry me. So I came back to Fairbanks in the spring on the SS Yukon on my way to Nome, and Mr. and Mrs. Volney Richmond Sr. were on the boat, sat at our table. Now, I forgot to tell you that my last year in Nome, I spent the first 5 years there working for the Alaska Road Commission on the Little Seward Peninsula Railway. But the last year, I was master mechanic for the Alaska Sunset Dredging Company on their dredge. And I was returning to that job in the spring when I was coming in on the SS Yukon and found this Mr. Richmond at our dining room table. And my pal that was on the dredge with me at Nome was with me. And he wanted to move the interior, and I did too. And we played deck shuffle with Mr. Richmond and went ashore with him and his wife at all the little ports along the way. And I finally heard that he was head of a NC company, and they were the Caterpillar distributors. And by golly, I thought, I'm going to hit this guy up for a job. So I asked him if there was any opportunity to get on with him, that I was like to move over to the interior from Nome. Well, he didn't know. He'd see when he got to Fairbanks. So to make a long story short, we came into Fairbanks, and Hans Meyer was flying over from Nome, and the Weeks Field was all, snow was all gone, the grass was all green in Fairbanks, and Nome still had 2 feet of snow on the field. So Hans had to land down at the lake on the Mendel Flats. Oh, I forget the name of it. Anyway, as far as he could come on skis, but Bill Lavery was flying out of here on skis yet. But he had a little grassy strip across on the far side of Wakes Field and a couple of mud holes in the middle of it that kind of wet things up a little bit. And he could take off with skis yet, with one pasture at a time, and ferry us down to this lake where Hans was sitting with his plane on skis. So I went out, and I was the first one down. My partner, Irving T. McGuire, waited for the second trip. And apparently, while I was being ferried down there in the first trip, Mr. Richmond had run out and saw Mr. McGuire and told him he wanted to head me off. If I wanted to work here in Fairbanks, I could, and to send word on over to me that if I wanted to come back to Fairbanks, I had a job here. So the next trip down brought Irving, and he said I had a job in Fairbanks, I wanted to come back, but gee, we're already on our way to Nome. So we go on over to Nome, and I sell my cabin, my dogs, and my dog sled, and ship everything to Fairbanks, and I come over to Fairbanks, and I start to work for the NC Company. This company, remember, that I'd never speak to again when I paid $1.50 a gallon for gas at Kotlik. And the ironical part of it all is I have just retired from 30 years of service in their employee. But I came over to Fairbanks and went to work for the NC Company. And I spent about 3 months in their machine shop running the big lathe. When Mr. Richmond came along and asked me if I would transfer to the Caterpillar department. And I said, well, you know, Mr. Richmond, that's what I asked you for in the first place, and I'd be very happy to. So I spent 25 years there as service manager and have just now retired from them. But to get back to my story, I worked there as service manager all that summer until September when Maglin came north to join me, and I had just flown down to Marshall to put a new crankshaft in a Caterpillar engine for the young, tall young guy worked for Standard Oil for a while. His father and him both mined down there. Anyway, Jim Dodson flew me down. No. The Flying Cowboy did. No. Oscar Winchell flew me down, and Jim Dodson brought me back. But Maglin was coming up to Fairbanks, and we were to be married, and she was coming in to Valdez and on the stage to Fairbanks, and I was down at Marshall about the time she was due here. And I finished this job as quick as I could, and I caught Jim Dodson coming home. And I said, say, listen, fella, I just got to get into Fairbanks tonight. Well, he said, it's going to be dark. I don't think we can make it. But we came up flying up the Yukon. I says, let's stop at Ruby, and I'll grab a couple of sandwiches, and we'll go on into Fairbanks yet tonight. He says, you're crazier than a bedbug. I says, you stay right here in the plane. I'll get some sandwiches, and we'll go on through. Well, it was pitch dark with a bright full moon. And we came in and had to land down here in this second bend on the Chena River in the moonlight. And I'll never forget Jim Dodson. He says, you're crazy. He says, you're crazier than I am. And I says, well, how crazy were you? He says, well, I drove across 3 states nonstop to marry my wife in Florida. He said, and then I spent the next 3 years trying to get rid of her. But anyway, we came in and landed. And I caught the pickup the next morning, and I drove down to Rika Wallens. And the stage had just driven up on that side of the river, and the ferry was on that side of the river, and I was on this side of the river. I waited for it to come over. Maglin was on it. And she joined me in the pickup, and her girlfriend came up with her to be bridesmaid. And we drove into Fairbanks together. And the next morning, lo and behold, we go up to the commissioner's office to buy a marriage license. And who do you think sells it to us?
Bill Groudon.
Bill Groudon, it was ACS Telegraph, man. When we run into him at Ruby and when he gave me the money to go on to St. Michael. Well, that brought us up to 1937. I came over here, started to work for the NC Company May the 7th, 1937. Now, a few years after that, at that time, we did not have, the NC Company did not have an agency in Juneau and Anchorage and Ketchikan and Whitehorse like they do now. So I was servicing the whole territory. And I had to go down to Sitka, Kodiak, Juneau, and Anchorage on all these different service trips. And I had to go over to Dawson, take the pickup there and go to the 60 mile and the 40 mile and all over Dominion and Bonanza and Sulphur Creek and visit all the miners in that area. So lo and behold, along comes the trip. We had sold a new cat to some miner that was mining on Ballarat Creek. And I looked up on the map where Ballarat Creek, and it's just about a half a mile up Yukon River from the mouth of Coffee Creek, where I'd gotten lousy and run into this bear hunter. And I thought, well, this is going to be a thrill. How am I going to get to Ballarat Creek? So I went over to NC Company in Dawson, and the parts were there for this tractor, and I had to go up and put them in. But they didn't know how they'd get me up there. Well, the barber, the local barber, was just ready to go moose hunting. And he had a big launch. And he wanted to go up the Stewart River. And Ballarat Creek's only about 10 or 12 miles on upstream from the mouth of the Stewart River. So the manager of the NC store made a dicker with him that he would furnish him the gas, clear to Ballarat Creek and clear on up the Stewart River to where he wanted to go moose hunting, if he'd take me up and drop me off at Ballarat Creek. So he did. And when I landed at Ballarat Creek with my parts, and he turned around, came back downstream to go up the Stewart River, these folks came down to pick me up with their truck and so forth, and the head geologist from Ottawa was visiting them, looking at their mine and reporting on rocks and minerals in that area. And he had gone up there from Dawson, and he'd taken a little rowboat with him on the steamer when he went up, and they let it off so he could take it to go back down to Thistle Creek, where there's the dredge operation. That's just opposite the mouth of the White River. So when I landed there, I saw this little rowboat on the bank of the river, and then when I got up to this people's mine and met the geologist, he was going to use that to get back down to Thistle Creek, and then he would flag the sternwheeler when she came downstream the next trip to pick him up there. So I finished my job just about the same time he finished his job, so he propositioned me to ride down to Thistle Creek with him, and I was supposed to visit the dredge at Thistle Creek, and so that worked out just fine. So we finished our jobs, and we started downriver in this rowboat, and I don't believe the man had ever been in a rowboat in his life. He'd get his arms crossed and everything else when he was trying to row, and he'd go around in circles, and I took that about as long as I could, and I asked him if I could row a while. So we got the boat straightened out and started downstream, and I pulled over and stopped at Coffee Creek. And there was nothing there but this old abandoned cabin and this little woodshed that we'd gotten lousy in. And I asked where these people were. And he says, why, they're just down at the mouth of the next creek. They moved over from the left limit to the right limit of the Yukon River and about 3 miles further down. So I says, I want to go in there and see them. Well, he knew them real well. So we pulled up there on the dock, and her husband was on the dock and met us, and just to kid him, now you remember, he was up in the hills cutting wood when we stopped there the first time, Lyman and I. We'd never seen him, so I kidded him a little bit, and I said, well, it's not you I want to see, it's your wife I want to see. I don't know you. Well, she's up in the house. Go up and see her. And it was about 200 feet up the bank to the cabin door, and I went up and started to knock on the cabin door, and it's one of these big, long shotgun houses, and a screen door in the front. Up in that country, they don't have visitors very much, and this typical swearing I'm telling you about was still with her, and I went up to the front door, and I knocked on the front door, and here she's standing in the middle of our, well, Jesus Christ, you don't have to knock, why don't you come in? And I walk in and I says, well, that certainly sounds like you. That's just the way I heard you last time I saw you. Well, now, when's the last time you saw me? I said, do you remember two men that came down the Yukon in the spring of 1931? Are you the SB that outshot me with your rifle? She'd remembered every bit of it. And now, this August, the White Horse Centennial Group are having a flotilla down the river from White Horse to Dawson. I have written over and sent in my signature, my registration, and told them that I wanted to get down the river with their flotilla this August, and that I wanted permission to stop at Ballarat Coffee Creek on the way down and visit some friends, because I had just read their regulations and you must not leave the flotilla and so forth and so forth and so forth. And I haven't had an answer yet to see how it'll come out. But that takes us up to 1937. And we're here in Nome, in Fairbanks, working for the NC Company. We lived on Wendell Avenue the first year, first winter. Big two-story house. I drove by it about 2 years ago. Fire department was surrounded it and burning it down, and I thought I'd have some fun there too. This one fireman was standing out in the street and had a hose in his hand and was just keeping the grass wet around everything, and the whole thing was blooming up. I slid up like I was almost going to run into him and threw the door open. I said, hey, you can't burn that place up. I said, that's the place I spent my honeymoon in. He said, well, you're too late now. So the years go by. We have a son. He's now in Anchorage with the NC Company. We have a daughter married to our National Cash Register Company. And there again was a little coincidence. He graduated from high school here and joined the National Cash Register Company. They sent him to Denver to serve his apprenticeship and came back as a journeyman. And it always kind of made me smile when I'd look in the city directory. It would have James H. Cassidy, Service Manager, NC Company, James G. Cassidy, Serviceman, NCR Company, one right below the other. But he's now in Anchorage, still with the National Cash Register Company, and our daughter's married, and in Corvallis, has just finished school and teaching, or student teaching, and they'll be up here this spring. And that brings us up to one other incident. I told you it was L. McGee that we sat alongside of in the restaurant at Panama, and finally went up the river and bought his boat and continued on our trip. And lo and behold, I'm here working for the NC Caterpillar Department when he walks in and buys a cat and is a very famous miner up at Utopia Creek, and he's over at Manly Hot Springs now, and he was up by Miller House. And we've bumped into each other for every summer since. So between him and Bill Groudon and this coffee salesman that bought the gas and got a free ride from Tanana to Ruby, he was in here every year for a number of years, and we used to see one another. And in the meantime, I've spent 30 years flying all over Alaska, servicing equipment. The first 15 years of it was nothing but miners. All we knew was tractors for moving the dirt, diesel engines for running the pumps and selling hydraulic pipe and giants and so forth to mine with. And the war came, Pearl Harbor came, Jimmy came about the same time, and the miners died out. The Army took all their equipment away from them, the government did. They've never recovered, they've never returned, but in their place they started building the Alcan Highway. I can remember driving to Valdez. I had 52 light plants. And when I say 52, that reminds me of my canoe trip. We were 52 days from Seattle to Nome. And between here and Valdez, we had 52 light plants in all the little roadhouses, country stores, and so forth. And I used to drive servicing them, and I would stop below Rico Wallens, where Delta Junction is now. It didn't exist then. And there was a stake there where the survey crew had started the survey east of there. And I used to like to stop with pickup in the middle of the road and get out and climb in the back of it and look down through the trees and think, well, now they tell me there's going to be a road to the States someday, and this will be the north end of it. It's going to go right down through here. But I can't believe it. It's all those miles through Canada and all the miles from here to Whitehorse. I just don't believe it'll ever happen. But it was with a great deal of pleasure, satisfaction, that I delivered a group of cats at this very spot about 2 years later, and they run a straight line down there. If you know how straight that Alcan Highway is from Buffalo Center to Gitzburner down to Halfway House before it makes a wrinkle. And I rode these equipment down through there, servicing it clear as far as Tanna Cross, as far as Northway, when it was just as wide as the dozer blade. And then the next year they pushed it out wider, and then the next year it was paved. And all the other highways that have been built and paved in Alaska since, that we haven't seen a mine or serviced a mine for years. It's all contractors now and earth-moving equipment, except in the meantime the dew line started in up north. I had one... There was a coal mine up at Barrow, 70 miles south of Barrow, and finally he needed some work on his cat, and I flew up there with Sigween, and that was quite a thrill too. A single engine plane, foggy in Point Barrow, you couldn't get in there, and we went back and landed on a gravel bar in the Colville River, and he had a little tent put up there, and I can still remember Sig landing on that bar. We went in and spent all night in that tent, and he had a little Zenith radio sitting in the corner on a couple of oil cases, and he'd take a quarter out of his pocket, turn the radio on, he'd reach back here and call the ACS in Barrow to find out if the weather was clear enough so we could take off and go on into Barrow. We landed at Barrow and went down to the coal mine and did that job and came back, and he took, there was two other people wanted to come out when we did. The sand is pretty deep on that beach they land on in front of Barrow. He couldn't take us all off on it, so he rented a skin boat and sent two of us up the beach about 3 miles to where it was a little, just a slight raise, a higher ground, and the sand was a little firmer. And we went up there in the skin boat and hiked inland and waited for him, and he picked us up there. And then the next time I went up there, the Seabees had already landed and had a whole city there, and that's now the main Seabee camp. So we was up there on lots of our work, and then after that along comes the dew line, with a dew line station every 50 miles from Cape Romanoff, clear around to demarcation point, and we've worked at all of them, serviced all of them. In the meantime, our 30 years comes along and we retire from the NC Company, and we hear about a Tanana Yukon Historical Society, and we fool around with them a little bit, and A67 comes along, and to bring this thing to a close pretty soon, we better sign off. But we find ourselves busy now helping the NC Company create an 1898 model trading post down at A67. Besides, the A67 group got a hold of me last year and wanted me to refurbish the engine room on the steamer Nenana and try and make the wheel turn for the show. And there again is quite a kick to me. I think more so to me than it would be to most anybody else. Because for years I used to have to catch the freight train out of here with Guy Jennings and ride the caboose or something and go to Nenana and unload tractors that were shipped in from outside on the railroad
park them in a row down at Nenana out in the field or any place. Then the spring after the ice went out, and they'd lowered the boats off of the ways back into the river and got steam up and were loading them up ready for their first trip delivering freight down the river. I'd have to go down to Nenana and start up these tractors and drive them on the barges that were tied on the front of this steamer. And then I'd have to ride the steamer down the river and deliver them to different mines at Manly Hot Springs and Tananaw and Ruby and so place, and ride the steamer back again. And I never for the life of me ever thought I'd be working in that engine room trying to make it look like it had just stopped operating yesterday when I was riding her then and she was alive and in full swing. So this would close out 37 years of Alaska for Jim Cassidy. There's one other item that collecting pictures for this old trading post. I got a hold of some pictures the other day of Slaterville. I started to tell you that we lived the first winter on Wendell Avenue, the second winter on 3rd Avenue with Gene Schultz. And then we went over in Slaterville, and he had just surveyed and divided that all up into lots, and we bought a lot over there. We were the first house to start building in Slaterville, when there wasn't a house in Slaterville, just Slater's old house and the greenhouse next to it. And I have two different pictures of an air view of the whole area, but not even our house there. Now it's all houses. And we're about to sell that house and buy a burro, little two-wheel cart, and go traveling. In the meantime, you'll have to get somebody else to run this machine alongside of me. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you.